This podcast is brought to you by WEDI, the preeminent national membership association for health IT guidance and collaboration. Recognized and trusted as a formal advisor to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, WEDI is the leading authority on the use of health IT to efficiently improve health information exchange, enhance care quality, and reduce cost. To learn more about WEDI member benefits and educational offerings, please visit our website, wedi.org. Welcome to the Collective Voice of Health IT, a WEDI podcast. Hi, everyone. It's Michael McNutt with WEDI. Here's a callback from episode 144. Here's part two of how community-based organizations leverage data to support health equity. The moderator is Dr. Mark Rabner, Chief Medical Officer with CRISP Shared Services, and the panel is Leanne Eagle with MAC and Living Well Center of Excellence, Stephanie Archer-Smith with Meals on Wheels of Central Maryland, June Simmons with Partners in Care Foundation, and Dr. Monique Powell-Davis with Mary Center. This was recorded at our health equity event in February in Washington, D.C.
So we've heard a little bit about how data is used in all your organizations. I think one thing I heard was how do we show benefit to the healthcare system? And I think there's a lot of tie-in, this is in terms of funding and sustainability for how your organizations are getting referrals, paying for referrals, and then how do you create a sustainable system that can help address the huge need in our communities?
Well, first of all, I'd have to say, as the California person on the panel, California is supposed to be out front, but I have CRISP envy. And the uniformity of your systems and the resources it brings you makes you a best practice. We have things like when we get that list of people we want to pursue, we're using something called Collective Medical, which is a health information exchange just for emergency rooms. Not all emergency rooms, but at least it's real time. Things like that really help us. In California, with its many millions of people, is now rolling out a health information exchange. So we'll be following, we hope, in your footsteps, because it is critical. I think there's so much duplication. There's so much loss of staff time. There's so much opportunity to have tech really be the enabling tool where we can identify and find people. A list, even on IT, doesn't really do it. So we have to go to Collective Medical, for example. The list has people who are frequent ER users. We have to go look at all their visits and see who did they list as the emergency contact in each and try each of those people in order to find these people. Maybe it's because we're a big place, but it's easy to disappear in our community, and these are not always stable and continuously housed people. So these, I think, are very important, and so we're excited to pursue, and actually our agency was the first CBO to sign up for the Health Information Exchange, because I see what yours does and the power it's had for quite some time, and we're helping lead other CBOs into that fold now as it begins to roll out in our state. These, I think, are really important. And then that data has to be used, of course. So we can talk about how do you actually get behavior change, not just from the people who have health challenges, but the people in the health system. We have a saying about what happens. A champion will take us into a health payer or health provider system to integrate social care, and then people in that system have to make it happen. And we know if we sat at the lunch table with them, here's what they would say: make me change my workflow and I'll have to kill you. So there are lots of reluctances to change human behavior that are quite natural, and we can't underestimate those forces that are at play that slow this change down. Otherwise, we would all just follow your path instantly. But we're glad you created the path so we can follow in your footsteps.
Thank you, June. I think we still have a lot to learn. But with the IT, I would say, being a hub, we're always called upon to work on the weakest link, right? So that means, like, when we try to really bring in all the multicultural organizations that maybe not be able to get onto CRISP. So that's one of the biggest challenges, is really to meet all of the needs in Maryland. And so that's why we have tried working with CRISP and working with them. We actually use another form of a platform that they can put their information in. And then we're looking to get an API with Chris, what we're currently working on, actually, that would bring that information across. Because we do look at ourselves as the hub, and we're only going to be as strong as that weakest link. So that's why we really have tried to really look at the Chinese culture centers, the Korean organization, like all these organizations that we're not, you think of health, you think of health equity, but we've got to reach down into places where that nobody else is getting. So that's one thing that we strive to do. And we always say that it's about partnerships. It's about the innovation. That's where I think, and it's also about collaboration and working together. And we really try to align ourselves with the governor and Westmore and what he's doing around that multi-sector plan in Maryland. And we have strong relationships with the foundations. Do we stumble and fall? Yes, a lot. But we try to learn from it. Thank you.
Yeah, I echo the sentiments that they share here when it comes to us working more closely together in all sectors, when it comes to breaking down all of the things that keep us siloed, not only from a partnership relationship, but also when you look at the many different ways that data flows through, it just doesn't directly communicate. It's almost like, I shared this earlier, now I have a larger library of data to go through to find that nugget that I want or need to put into my electronic medical record. So the more we work to identify those areas where we have challenge and partner and leverage the trust that we have built with our individual communities, I think the more we're likely to bring in those marginalized, underrepresented areas where data is not even captured yet, right? Where people are outside of our CRISP network. And some of them intentionally remain that way for reasons where we could build trust to overcome. I think what we call, what you're referring to in California here in this area, those attribution lists that you get from, that we get from our partners, those are a big challenge, right? The list is huge, and often the information not valid, can't find them, and we, you know, continue to try. I mean, you, just like you said, we get 1,000 and maybe we can reach 20%. And then maybe of those 20% still is smaller. So I think we have miles to go when it comes to really wrapping a full, you know, our arms around our community fully. And there has to be some way that technology and data that's available and used in other realms, because people in the community engage in technology in all other sectors of our community. Why can't we find a way to have them bridge over to us more readily. And I think that's an area of focus that we are constantly challenged with in our organization. And I know we work with our partner FQHCs in the city and in Maryland to come up with ways to melt away and address those challenges and learn from each other on things that we've tried that have been successful and those that weren't so. So that's what I've put out there.
So I think, you know, the issue around partnership and collaboration and you know, breaking down silos is also critical. It's also really critical that that we be prepared as organizations to do this work. And as, you know, as an executive director, I'm sort of always thinking about that, right? What's, you know, what's the, what is it going to take to serve 100 more people? What is it going to take to serve 200 more people? So we have to think about, you know, how we can scale our services in a way that's responsible. So it becomes really that much more important to be able to understand the data, the numbers, how many people are eligible, how that data flows, and trying to get that data to flow in a consistent way. When you have lots of different contracts and different partnerships, you get trickles. Sometimes you might get one or two referrals here, and you might get five referrals there. Then you might get a really big spike. And how do you prepare for that? But if we can kind of, you know, even that out a little bit with, you know, a system that uses the data to identify people and refer them efficiently and effectively, then that's going to help us respond to that need. And of course, you know, with that comes really sort of placing a value on that work. We have to be able to build that infrastructure to respond, and that infrastructure has a value. And so making sure that that we recognize that these are services that are valuable and should be paid for. Right now, a lot of the projects for most service providers are grant-funded projects. And they're often one-off projects. So what happens when the grant funding has expired? We need to be able to build this into the service delivery system. And that, to me, would be the best thing we could do to create a sustainable model.
Fantastic. Thank you. So we have about 10, 12 minutes left. So I want to give space for the audience to ask some questions. And while you all are collecting your thoughts and raising hands, I'll ask to the panel, not necessarily all of you, but whoever wants to respond, to kind of take Stephanie's question another step. How do you think about sustainable funding mechanisms? Where and how can those be implemented? And how do you see scaling your organizations?
There's a multiplicity of emerging payment systems for services, for social care services. CMS's new rules, I think, can be quite powerful, and I think it's now 15 states that are doing Medicaid kinds of transformation in our state. One of the issues is capital to build these kinds of systems, including software, but other kinds of infrastructure development and as a hub. We hope to save a range of other agencies from duplicating that investment, and the state is making available funding for infrastructure development. So if they can pay to train staff, equip them with laptops or other kinds of devices to liberate them into the field, if they can help us with recruitment, because in our county alone, there's 106 languages. There's tremendous diversity, and we want to recruit and incorporate a wide range of agencies. As you said, the hub should enclose a team, a regional team of multicultural, multilingual, widely trusted through diverse sources. So having upfront public or private funding, because they both can end as grants, is empowering, I think. And then mastering the new billing codes that have come out for the Penn and CHI, for the new Medicaid, in lieu of services, community health worker supports. There's quite an array, and there's a lot of work being done through the partnership to align social care and through the federal departments Kelly mentioned to bring that data out so we can all master it, get it in place, because that's programming. That's billing systems that communities never had but need to have. These, I think, are big opportunities for us.
I think it's important to have a balanced portfolio. Like we try to balance the amount of grants we have versus the contracts. We're like a line item in the hospital budgets with the CTO. So that really helps, and we're able. Like Maryland is unique. We all know we're different. But we have HART funds in Maryland, so we're able to have contracts around those HART funds. We would say one of the biggest challenges around that is we have to be nimble because we're pulled to do state projects and, in the State Department on Aging. So being that flexible, I think, is very, very important.
I agree 100%. I think that... gathering the stakeholders when you apply for funding, right? Advocating with jurisdictions for programs that you have proof of concept based upon the grants that you've had in the past. Those are the things that we have been able to do in some circumstances, sort of leverage based upon the outcomes that our data will show to influence policy on how the payers value what we've done. And we're not always successful or haven't always been successful doing that. But in many cases, because we continue to, the healthcare providers are a part of they're in the partnership. They want good outcomes for their patient. So when they see an opportunity to support something, we're able to shift support dollars to support that. And I think that is, exactly how we, extend private funding into the public space to care for the communities we serve better.
All right, questions from the audience.
Hello, so my first question is that a common theme that I've seen in all of these presentations and your conversation as well is the concept of self-efficacy, particularly with populations that you serve. And so my question is that how can we as health tech organizations work to kind of provide tools, tangible or otherwise, that can continue to reach out to communities in order to promote self-efficacy and patient advocacy within our target populations?
I want to be sure we understand the question. How are you a provider, a plan?
Oh, no, I'm just curious to kind of get your perspectives on sort of what can we do to provide tools that are intangible to in order or otherwise to promote self-efficacy within patient populations.
Oh, thank you. Well, for one thing, our governance should include voice of those served. People with lived experience need to be also in the staffing system, in our opinion. Healthcare hopefully is moving money over from avoidable late-stage care to upstream investments, but we need to think through how does that really work for the people to be served, who to target, who's willing to accept, how many tries does it take, what kind of system really works for people. There's so much to learn because we've been, come and I will serve you. Now it's the opposite of that. It's how can we get better results together? So co-design with health plans, with health payers, with people served, with people with lived experience, I think extremely important to guide us as we evolve a new ecosystem of social and healthcare.
Hi, I'm a retired geriatrician, primary care physician, spent a long career referring people back and forth, transitions of care. And I think the new Medicare, Medicaid, value-based payment plans scheduled to go online in 2030 may offer a great opportunity to find a path to sustainable funding by tapping into the healthcare funds, which seem to be the biggest game in town anyway. And it makes sense to, look there. So one of the questions I have is, as a primary care physician, I don't recall formally referring patients to community-based service organizations. And I certainly don't recall getting any information back from them. So is there any conversations going on about what does the organization need to know on the basis of a referral from anywhere, but in particular the medical care system, and conversely, the information that the medical care system needs to know from the community-based organization, who, after all, are seeing the patient in their home frequently, much more often than the healthcare system?
I'm happy to address how we're looking at that with the FAST project that I mentioned earlier. And we have basically been working with the health providers to identify those social determinants of health that they are seeing. And there's a screening mechanism that's in place in Maryland that's now required as of January 1st, that you have to screen for these things. But we also know that there's information that we already have that before screening. Like, we know, for example, if someone lives in a particular zip code, if that is a food desert area, then food insecurity is going to be a risk for them. So those are the kinds of things that we would look at in terms of who would be a good referral to Meals on Wheels, and we kind of create that list of that risk and begin to stratify that risk. On the other side of that, with the FAST project, we are looking at the inclusion and exclusion criteria for each of the service providers that are participating. And that information comes together to say then, of these, 500 people that have been identified, and this sort of runs continuously. So it's not something like we heard about earlier, where maybe once a month a report is run, an attribute report is run, and then it's sent to a provider. This is running continuously. So these referrals are happening continuously. And that way we can get a steady stream of information. And we already know that the person is well matched for Meals on Wheels. We know where they live. We know how to reach them. The work comes in when sometimes we are dealing with those that are the most difficult to reach. And so we have to, as June said earlier, try again, right? So we don't just call them once and say, well, we couldn't reach them. We might call them, we might send a letter, we might call them again. And it takes, that kind of effort to do that. But to be able to have the information that we need to do that is important, and knowing that they've been well matched so that they are, as I said, they meet the inclusion criteria for Meals on Wheels or one of the other organizations. I'm not sure.
We actually have a contract with my CTO, when we would get panels for everyone that had a fall in the last year. So that was an automatic push to us from that on my CTO. So they pick certain topics, and then we get a list of those people, and we reach out to them and get them enrolled. We also, with the ERs, we have a program where that doctor doesn't even have to send that referral. If they're coming into the ER and they've had a fall, it's an automatic push to us. So they don't even have to refer those patients. It's just something they put into Epic, and the Epic is hooked to Chris. So it's an automatic push. We're getting ready to do the same thing around some other topic areas. But we actually have all of our programs are written out into CRISP, as well as the SDOH. This is some of the stuff we're working in with Cody, building out the platform around the SDOH, so they can get that feedback back through CRISP. So that this is just some of the things that we are working on as a hub.
But the research shows that the most powerful is that a provider actually speaks to a person. The person knows they're being referred, that they know why, and that the receiving entity can hear. And there's lots of IT now that really does closed loop referral to send a referral to CBO and to respond what happened. Ideally, funding for the service accompanies that. But just to note, because you mentioned 2030, the new CMS physician payment rules that allow contracting for even community health workers through a medical practice or through an FQHC are in effect now. They took effect January 1, and they can really be a robust addition once we master how to deploy them exactly, but there are a lot of new abilities to partner social and healthcare together and weave their financing together as well.
Well, I wish we had more time. One more question?
Yep. We have time for a couple more questions, but we do have one here virtually on Zoom. Are any of you collecting data around the cause of a social need as opposed to just its existence? So many folks make assumptions such as food insecurity is always financial, but those assumptions are often wrong, and that leads to a mismatch in the services offered versus what would be helpful.
I like that question a lot because I often feel that the tools that we use to collect the social determinants of health information doesn't delve into the why behind it at all. But in the work that we do at Mary Center, we have care coordinators and family support workers who save space in that communication to flesh that out. And it may not be documented in the SDOH screener, but it will exist in their record to reflect those challenges so that they can then be linked to other very specific, tailored to what may be going on. Sometimes underlying the food insecurity is some domestic violence, or there is a job insecurity, or some other aspect of life that impacts the answer to that question. And so while it's not captured, I do think it's important. I think it's valuable, and it has direct impact on what you can and should be doing to support that person.
Or it might be a neighborhood with no fresh food available. There might be, systemic environmental community levels that drive a lot of these challenges as well, as you note.
Is this on? I can speak up. Thanks. Thank you so much for your talk. I have a question about participating in HIEs and what the lift is like for your legal teams to evaluate your participation. This may be most relevant for you, June, since you're on the cusp of doing so through California's HIE, but can you talk a little bit about what that lift is like?
Well, we're just entering. I think the privacy rules, all those pieces are supposedly being answered by the HIE, but I think your question is correct. What does it mean? What kind of load will it free? It sounds like with CRISP, it is tremendous efficiencies and opportunities that are achieved, which you can speak to, and great advances in how we support people together rather than in silos, I think is a big opportunity to say whatever it takes, it's worth it.
If I understand your a question directly, is like, what does it take to be a part of an HIE? Is that your question?
Yeah, is there any training or like getting your legal folks up to speed on what you're asking?
Yeah, they'll be afraid.
Yeah, that was tough at first. It took about 8 months. And Stephanie and I were one of the first two, correct, Stephanie? And I think it's because we had the support of the state and the Maryland, and the Maryland physicians and all of that. So I'm going to let Mark answer that question because I think I'm going to pass the buck here because I think that this is a good question for him.
That's right. Stay tuned. Tomorrow, our legal counsel will be here as well. I think of it as like different layers of connectivity as well. So a community-based organization can join the HIE to receive referrals, for example. In other situations, like for the FAST project, there's a business associate agreement between the healthcare delivery site, who was a CRISP participant, and this community-based organization. That took like 9 months. And it was a real challenge because the different organizations speak different languages. Understanding kind of even like things like health IT insurance is very foreign to a lot of organizations, and some healthcare entities require different things out of the BAA. And so if you're going to scale relationships between healthcare and social care community-based organizations, there needs to be an easier way to create those relationships without 9 months of BAA wrangling. And so we don't have a great solution to that yet, but it's certainly a challenge. And then there's other organizations like Mac Living Well that is a HIPAA-covered entity and so can get access to CRISP because they are a HIPAA-covered entity. And so there's these different layers of connectivity and different data sharing that's allowed because of those different relationships.
And if I could just add some of the complexities for a CBO also, because in order for us to get that BAA passed, even though it took 9 months, we had to already have things in place and they had to have a level of competence. So we had to be able to show that we did have cybersecurity insurance and we had liability insurance was at the appropriate level and that we had HIPAA training and that we had all of these things that were in place so that they would have a level of confidence in working with us in this way.
That's one of the advantages of the hub. The hub can carry some of those burdens on behalf of the many agencies, and they can ride the same horse, so to speak.
Another question from the Zoom audience. How do you deal with patient consent issues around community services? You're talking about automatic referrals, but referral for community services should require patient consent before information is sent.
Can I take a quick pass on that first? The automated referrals are for either HIPAA-covered entities or an entity that has a business associate agreement with the HIPAA-covered entity. Other patients, if you're making a referral through the Office of Civil Rights, FAQ to HIPAA, there's the allowance for referrals with minimum necessary information with patient assent. So the patient needs to know that you're making that referral to the community-based organization. So it's, again, kind of tied to that layer, levels of legal agreements. And that's where I think health information exchanges are valuable because we can implement central governance that is specific to each state and each jurisdiction that we work with so that we can make sure that all the appropriate legal requirements are being followed.
And there's a box that the that a physician or hospital checks in CRISP that gives us the ability to call that patient, that they have gotten the consent from the patient. So that's part of the reason why now that we're going to move more towards all CRISP referrals, we want them in CRISP. We're even going to the point that we go to the physician practice and actually help them to get the information into CRISP because they sometimes struggle with that.
But then you still need the patient to agree to be served. So in a world of fear and mistrust, that's really the next big step that's really important to earn that trust.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the issue of trust. And first, we'll say that we only get the necessary information to contact them. So we know that they've come through the system and they have matched criteria, but we don't know how they've matched that criteria. When we call them, when they hear that it's Meals on Wheels calling, they sort of relax. They're more likely to engage with us, and it's at that time that we get consent, and then we do a deeper dive on what their needs are through our case manager's comprehensive assessment that they do with them. But that's not until they consent to have the service. I'll give you just a quick example of the trust issue and one of the early learnings that we had in one of our projects, that we originally were having those calls made by the physician's practice. So we were working with the Center for Successful Aging, and they were making the calls once they identified someone, asking them if they wanted to be engaged with Meals on Wheels services. And we had about a 20% acceptance rate. And as we were going through the project, we said, why don't we flip this? Why don't we let them know that they're being referred, get their permission for us to call them, and then we'll call them. And when we called them, our acceptance rate went up to about 50%. So it's that trusted service provider that they just felt more comfortable with.
So, Dr. Radner, knowing that you are going to be on the next panel, no pressure, but one of our biggest challenges, the hospitals absolutely understand the value and the return on investment. Where one of our struggles is, what about the physicians? They're locked into their reimbursement and their criteria, and they don't see a change in their bottom line when we, provide those community-based services.
Sure. It's a big question, so Leah, let's save it for the next one. It goes to the audience member's question about practicing for a very long time and not making a referral to a community-based organization. Where are the incentives to make those referrals and to identify social needs? We're starting to see that movement, but it's also who's the right person or people to be making those referrals and doing those assessments. Is it the physician? Is it a nurse? Is it a social worker? Is it someone else? Is it a community-based organization? And so I don't have the answers to those questions, but it goes to who's the right people and how are they getting funded. I think in Maryland is very unique because there's a total cost of care model. So if you can save money by going upstream to address social needs, you can get a return on investment for that work. And so I think that's unique to Maryland and not necessarily scalable right today, but to other jurisdictions. But it's a nice model that's shown to, we've had such these great relationships is because we have this model in Maryland that can give us that space and give us stakeholders that are interested in moving upstream from a volume-based system to a value-based system.
This has been the Collective Voice of Health IT, a WEDI podcast, where the healthcare IT communities connect, collaborate, and create solutions for a better health system. Find all our episodes as well as information on our association at our website, wedi.org. Thank you for joining us, and be safe.